It's Friday, December 13, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Tomorrow marks the tragic one-year anniversary of the shootings of 26 people at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. 28 people in total died, including the shooter, Adam Lanza, and his mother, who he killed in her house before going to the school, and killing 26 people, including 20 first graders and then six school employees. It happened on December the 14th of 2012. And as we think of that one-year anniversary, we need to remember the fact that there will be many grieving people in Newtown, Connecticut, and far beyond, for whom this one-year anniversary will be the anniversary of the most tragic and unthinkable, indeed unspeakable, thing they could have imagined: the death of 20 first graders and six school employees, and the mass murder that is ranked second, coming after only the Virginia Tech shooting that took place in 2008, in which the shooter killed 32 people and then himself. How do you consider this kind of anniversary? From a Christian worldview perspective, we need to recognize that as God made us, chronological creatures who live so much of our lives with reference to memory, there is both a blessing and a curse in this kind of memory. Even for those grieving families in Newtown, Connecticut, there will be both blessing and curse in this one-year anniversary. Because after all, we would not want to be the creatures who do not remember our loved ones. Even if they are taken from us by such tragedy, indeed murderous tragedy, we would not want to forget them. This is one of the quandaries of the human experience, including the quandary of the Christian experience. There are memories that are for us unspeakably sad, and yet at the same time, we would not want to be creatures whose memories are wiped out, so that we no longer remember these tragedies, and that would mean also not remembering the people we love so much who were taken from us or harmed in them. For the people of Newtown, Massachusetts, and beyond, the big question is, one year later, how do you get on with life? One of the interesting aspects of this city's response with the one-year anniversary looming is that the city did two things, and did so rather officially. In the first place, the city said that it would not have any organized reflection upon the event to commemorate the one-year anniversary. The explanation of that that came from the city council there is immediately understandable. It is simply too tragic. It is too painful. It would cause more pain than blessing, more pain than comfort, to have the city commemorate this event. The other side of this is also very interesting. The city asked the national media to stay away. This is the first case, to my knowledge, in which the national media on this kind of scale have announced that they will not go to the city on this anniversary and will defer to the city's wishes. For instance, USA Today editor-in-chief David Calloway said that USA Today will not report on the anniversary from Newtown on Saturday. He said, quote, "We'll respect the wishes of the people of Newtown." Other organizations, including CNN, have announced that they also will not be in Newtown, even as they will, in their own way, cover the tragedy anniversary. CNN spokeswoman Bridget Leininger said, quote, "While CNN plans to cover the one-year anniversary across our networks and platforms, we are respecting the wishes of the families, and we are not reporting from Newtown on Saturday," end quote. Last month, a massive investigative report on the tragedy was released by law enforcement officials in Connecticut. Many questions were answered, and of course, much of the information that came just made the situation appear not only more tragic, but more twisted. For instance, Adam Lanza, the 20-year-old who committed this tragic crime, kept a spreadsheet of mass murders, reports the LA Times, hated to be touched, did not allow anyone, including his mother, into his bedroom. He covered his bedroom windows with black trash bags, disliked birthdays and holidays, would not let his mother put up a Christmas tree, and made her get rid of a cat because he didn't want it in the house, end quote. As it also turned out, he had communicated even with his mother only by email for months leading up to the shootings. And furthermore, given all of that background, including the fact that his mother, who was the first victim in terms of the shooting spree, his mother knew he was deeply troubled. She had bought him a gun even in the weeks leading up to the shooting and lived in a house that was filled with guns and ammunition. There's so many questions, but the big question, of course, is the question of why. And, as virtually every media and cultural observer has noted in terms of this massive report from law enforcement in Connecticut, that's the one question that isn't answered. That's not to say it isn't asked. For instance, in the 48-page report, there arrives this question, quote, "The obvious question that remains is, why did the shooter murder 27 people, including 20 children? Ultimately, that question may never be answered," end quote. Well, you don't have to use the word ultimately there. And as a matter of fact, the word ultimately actually doesn't fit. In our time, given our ability, given the limits of our knowledge, we will never be able to answer that question. Even in the Bible, the question is asked about the wickedness of the human heart and the acknowledgement that we can't understand it. The depravity of the human heart is so twisted and so deep and so pervasive that we, ourselves human sinners, can't even understand the depth of our sinfulness. We can't understand the strange, twisted mental calculations that go into the mind of Adam Lanza. And on a smaller scale, we can't even understand some of the ways we think ourselves. But the word ultimately doesn't fit here, because even though in this time, in this report, these law enforcement officials and the rest of us all put together can't answer this question, the use of the word ultimately here will ultimately fail. Because one day, when the thoughts and intentions of every heart are made known, we will understand, or at least these things will be revealed. And until then, we'll continue to scratch our heads, and we'll continue also to mourn with our hearts, knowing that this kind of tragedy, this kind of crime, this kind of shooting spree, the murder of 20 first graders and then 7 other people, leads us to understand that there are things that human sinners will do that no other human sinner can understand, even including the person involved in the crime. That doesn't remove in any sense the culpability. As a matter of fact, it simply increases the culpability and personal responsibility. But it does remind us that sin is so perplexing that it is irrational to the core. But our final word on this must be that this is another one of those crimes that reminds us of the need for a justice, the absolute hunger and thirst, the ache for a justice that no human court will ever be able to achieve. Even if Adam Lanza had lived, had he been tried and convicted of his crimes, had he been sentenced to lifetimes in prison or executed, the reality is he will never be able to pay for his crimes, and true justice would never have been achieved, even though its approximation would have been necessary. But in this case, we're going to have to wait for the ultimate court of justice, and we are those who know that that judge and that justice is surely coming. But now, let's all remember what took place a year ago in Newtown, Connecticut, and pray for all those involved, and pray, if there is any way possible, that this would somehow, even on this one-year anniversary, point at least some people to the gospel. The Pew Research Religion and Public Life Project is out with a major report. It was released yesterday. And one of the most interesting aspects is that it reveals the scale of change we knew had happened, but the scope of it just goes beyond what we might have thought had actually taken place. For instance, in 1910, about two-thirds of the world's Christians lived in Europe. That's right. Go back just a century and 3 years, and the vast majority, two-thirds of all the Christians in the world, lived in Europe. And that's where most of the Christians had lived for the past 1,000 years and more. But now, just 103 years later, only about a quarter of all Christians live in Europe. That's 26%. And furthermore, a plurality, more than a third, now live in the Americas. That's 37%. Most of them in the United States, which, according to this report, is now by far the most populous nation when it comes to Christians of any nation in the world. About one in every four Christians lives in sub-Saharan Africa. That's 24%. About one in eight is found in Asia and in the Pacific. That's 13%. As Pew reports, the number of Christians around the world has nearly quadrupled in the last 100 years, from about 600 million in 1910 to more than 2 billion in 2010. But the world's overall population has also risen rapidly, from 1.8 billion in 1910 to 6.9 billion in 2010. So what does that mean? It means that, amazingly enough, the number of Christians is roughly proportional in the same way now as then. As Pew reports, as a result, Christians make up about the same proportion or portion of the world's population today, 32%, as they did a century ago, 35%. Big news in this report is the growth of Christianity in China, in the Pacific Rim, and in sub-Saharan Africa. The share of the population of Christians in sub-Saharan Africa was only 9% in 2010. Now it's 63%. That's a massive increase. It represents incredible evangelism taking place in sub-Saharan Africa. As Pew remarks, Christianity in this age, today, unlike a century ago, is truly a global faith. It wasn't in 1910, but it is in 2010, and now, of course, in 2013. This massive research project, now released, is known as Global Christianity, a report on the size and distribution of the world's Christian population. And there is so much here, it will demand more attention in the future. But at this point, the big take-home, the headline news out of this report, is the fact that the center of gravity in terms of Christianity in the world, certainly Christian population, has moved from Europe to North America, right now to the United States in particular. But looking at the growth trends of the future in Africa and in Asia, it becomes very clear that if these trends continue, as we must pray that they will, the United States will not be the largest in terms of Christian population of the nations of the world for long. By the way, in case you were wondering about the 10 countries with the largest Christian populations, they come in this order. The United States is first, second is Brazil, third is Mexico, fourth is Russia, fifth is the Philippines, sixth is Nigeria, seventh is China, eighth is the Congo, ninth is Germany, the 10th is Ethiopia. Just imagine how many names on that list would have been nowhere near that list in 1910. Now we know what it looks like in 2010. If the Lord tarries, what will this list look like in the year 2110? We can only wonder. Earlier this week, we reported on the first legal same-sex marriages in Australia as the Capital Territory had moved earlier this week towards the legalization and the solemnation, the celebration of the first same-sex marriages there. Well, now it's all over. It's over because Australia's highest court has struck down that law, saying that the federal parliament and only the federal parliament has the right to establish marital law in the nation of Australia. The judgment said this, quote, "The Marriage Act does not now provide for the formation or recognition of marriage between same-sex couples. Thus, the court ruled, quote, that act is a comprehensive and exhaustive statement of the law of marriage under the Constitution and federal law as it now stands. Whether same-sex marriage should be provided for by law is a matter for the federal parliament," end quote. That means the 27 couples who got married earlier this week with the laws that were then in effect have now had their marriages declared invalid. As Al Jazeera is reporting, gay marriage has been explicitly outlawed in Australia since 2004, almost 10 years ago, when the then Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard, amended the Marriage Act to specify that such unions were only valid between a man and a woman. We need to note that efforts to legalize same-sex marriage in Australia will continue, but the fact that same-sex marriage is not legal there right now is something of a standout in the Southeast Asian region when it comes to the nations of Australia and New Zealand, because New Zealand has already moved to the legalization of same-sex marriage, and given the secularization of the nation of Australia, it is likely that this will continue to be a very fierce debate, and those who are pressing for the legalization of same-sex marriage there are not going to consider this decision the last word. Shifting to the state of Michigan, in the middle of this week on Wednesday, the legislature in Michigan passed a law that will require residents of Michigan who want health insurance coverage for abortions to buy an extra policy. As is reported by ABC News, this came after Republican legislators passed the law on Wednesday over the objections of Democrats. The Citizens Initiative was approved 62-47 by the House and 27-11 in the Senate. That is a massive vote, and it is so massive that there is no need for the governor of Michigan even to sign the legislation. He vetoed it a year ago. Now it was passed by such supermajorities that it is impossible that the governor can veto the law. It will simply pass into law without his signature. Michigan then becomes the ninth state to restrict private plans, insurance plans, that is, from covering the abortion procedure. What's most important here? This is the state of Michigan. One of the things the pro-abortion and pro-choice movements have been trying to stress in terms of the public debate is that opposition to abortion is geographically localized. Well, it is geographically concentrated. But that's true for many moral issues where you have concentrations of moral liberals on the two coasts and university cities spotted in the heartland, but the vast heart of the country being deeply conservative on many issues. But the issue of abortion, when you're looking at these kind of restrictions, the headlines have been coming predominantly from states such as Texas. This is the state of Michigan. Michigan is the quintessential so-called swing state in national politics and presidential elections. What this tells you is that pro-life sentiment in this country is not limited to states like Texas, nor even to states in the South. It is not limited to those states that have predominantly voted Republican in presidential elections. It represents something that should give the pro-life movement a good deal of encouragement, even as the task ahead of us remains daunting and great. There is still the opportunity to help people to understand what abortion really represents, the murder of an unborn child, and help people then to make the right decisions about what to do when the reality of abortion is rightly understood. But now shifting to the state of Texas, headlines have come out of that state in the last part of this week because of a 16-year-old boy who was found guilty of causing a crash that left four people dead. The boy got drunk after stealing beer with friends. He was involved in an accident that was his fault that led to four people dead and several people injured, including some who have very devastating brain injuries even in the present. But here is why this court action is getting so much attention. The boy was not given time in prison. He was sentenced to 10 years probation, no jail time. But here in the CNN report by Dana Ford is the part that's getting most of the attention. I quote, to the defense, the youth is himself a victim of affluenza, according to one psychologist, the product of wealthy, privileged parents who never set limits for the boy, end quote. Fascinating legal debate going on here. These are very rich parents who have a very rich 16-year-old because of his rich parents. He has now qualified not only for all the things that got him into trouble in terms of the toys he used, including his pickup truck, that were involved in this accident, but also a very expensive legal defense. A legal defense that was capable of bringing in psychologists and psychiatrists to argue that the boy was himself the victim. That the victim of what? The psychological or psychiatric disease that was identified here was, to use the very word that they cited, affluenza, the disease of being too wealthy. As a matter of fact, the court psychiatrist brought into the case argued that the boy was not responsible or that his responsibility for the crime was mitigated by the fact that his own parents had given him everything that wealth and privilege can supply except any limits for the boy in terms of morality or behavior. And that was the argument straightforwardly made in court, that no limits whatsoever, no consequences of any kind had ever guided this boy's moral development. The 16-year-old boy was sentenced by a juvenile court judge in Texas on Tuesday to 10 years of probation. If he violates the terms of the probation, he could face up to 10 years of incarceration. That was released in a statement from the Tarrant County Criminal District Attorney's Office. By the way, the district attorney has registered outrage at the fact that no jail time is associated with this sentence, but the office also said they were powerless to appeal the judge's decision. Sonny Hostin, who is the legal analyst for CNN, got to part of the story that many others have neglected. The morality of this sentence and of this legal defense, given the wealth of the parents and thus of the boy, the defendant in this case. She said on CNN's Newday Morning Show, quote, it is unfair that other young defendants without the same wealth could end up in jail for a lot less. I think in terms of policy, this really flies in the face of our criminal justice system. There have to be consequences to actions, and that's what our system is about, even for juveniles, end quote. Well, a hearty endorsement to everything that analyst said. What we're looking at here is a miscarriage of justice. And conservatives, those who genuinely believe in the necessity of law and thus of law and order, rightly understood, constitutionally maintained, and communally respected, we have to understand that when justice can be bought and sold in terms of this kind of legal defense, we're in big trouble as a country. Oh, and when it comes to affluenza, let's accept the fact, first of all, that such a thing might actually exist as a problem. But the bigger problem, regardless of the wealth involved, is that these parents never set boundaries and limits for this young man. They never established any consequences for wrong action. They never disciplined him. They never established a moral context in which he could grow up to any kind of normal and moral adulthood. Thus, we have a 16-year-old boy whose life is now completely upended by the fact that he has committed this horrible crime. He has 10 years of probation. He's not, according to the judge, to be sent back to his family, but rather to a long-term treatment facility. But that pales over against families who've lost loved ones, the four people dead in this tragic accident, and others whose lives continue to be greatly harmed by the effects of this young man's action along with his friends. It's really hard to accept the argument that this boy's sentence should have been as it is, and that he should have had this reduced sentence with no jail time because of this supposed problem of affluenza. One of the problems we have in this country is trying to mitigate personal responsibility for any reason we can find. This is one of those reasons that makes sense to a society trying to avoid moral responsibility. But when it comes to moral responsibility, let's put his parents in the dock. Let's recognize that they too are responsible for this and perhaps directly responsible. The problem is not just that the 16-year-old boy was let off in terms of the moral responsibility for his actions, it's that his parents were too. But at least we can find some satisfaction that in the court's deliberations, their failure was documented clearly. We all need to watch and listen and learn from this one. Two major issues I discussed on the briefing this week are now available in essays and commentaries at albertmoeller.com. The first is this, A Moral Revolution at Warp Speed, now it's Wedding Cakes. And the second is America and the Culture of Vulgarity, No End in Sight. Those are available at albertmoeller.com. This morning at 10 o'clock, I want to invite you to watch the December 2013 commencement ceremony for the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I'll be speaking from Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2, speaking of the responsibility of the one called by God to teach and preach, to bring light, as was made so clear in that wonderful passage. You can watch by going to www.sbts.edu/live at 10 o'clock Eastern Time. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.